Thanks, Dalila. So I'll be talking about dark photon superradiance, what it is, how we can use it to test Bjornason and model physics, and how we get there, I guess. So the question that I at least partially try to answer in these 8 slides is, can we probe Bjornason and model physics, or even detect Bjornason and model physics using astrophysical probes? And by astrophysical, I mean specifically black holes in this talk. But more generally, you can imagine other systems where you can probe these systems, or Bjornason and model physics. And so the question that I might not have to answer here, but I generally have to answer is, why do we care about Bjornason and model physics? Well, mostly because the standard model isn't really complete. So there's things like the strong CP problem, which we can't explain without adding new particles to the model. Then there's dark matter, which may just be some primordial black hole distribution in the universe, but it may also be just some fundamental particle that we haven't discovered yet. And then, of course, low energy limbs of quantum gravity models might result in things like, you know, particles that we may be able to detect. So the obvious candidates that people usually talk about are the axion, which is just some scalar particle, and then the dark photon, which is some vector particle, which I'll be talking about in this talk mostly. But things apply also kind of to the axion in a qualitative way. And so the typical way people consider this is by coupling these particles to the standard model in a particular way. So for the axion, typically what people do in the astrophysics context is to consider the axion photon coupling, mostly because, you know, you can see photons, you can see things in the universe with observations of the EM, and so we want to create something that produces photons, and so people consider the axion photon coupling. And then equivalently for the dark photon, you can have something similar, which is the kinetic mixing, which basically, yeah, mixes the dark photon, or the massive vector boson that you can't see, into the standard model photon that you can see. And then through various mechanisms, you might be able to probe the existence of this ultralight vector boson. So what particle physicists love to see is plots like these, where you show the coupling. In this case, I'm focusing on the kinetic mixing between this ultralight vector boson and the standard model photon. So where you plot this coupling versus the mass of this new particle. And then what you show is a bunch of colors, which basically represent a bunch of different experiments or different ways of probing this particular part of parameter space. What exactly all of these are is not too important, but kind of generally, the larger the coupling, obviously there's more experiments and we are more sensitive to those regimes. And then the lower the coupling becomes, the more white there is. So basically, the less experiments there are around to test those parts of the parameter space. And then one special thing is this thing called black hole superradiance over here, which is basically just this gray band that extends all the way down to basically the coupling equals zero. And it's special because, it just assumes the gravitational coupling. So even if the kinetic mixing is zero, you will have some sort of effect. And I'll tell you what this effect is in just a second. And so basically what this means is that all the other experiments are kind of, or the sensitivity is kind of bounded from below by some value. But this superradiance process doesn't have this artifact and can probe basically all the couplings in a particular mass range. OK, so what is black hole superradiance? So as I was saying, I'm focusing on the massive vector case, but kind of this story also applies to the scalar case. So here you have the Lagrangian, just the kinetic term for the A prime. The A prime is the massive field in this talk. And then the mass term. You can imagine there might be some, you know, UV complete theory that generates this mass term. I'm not going to go into, you know, whether there's a Higgs mechanism at high energies or not, but just assume that this is some, you know, EFT approach where I just say, okay, this is the particle at the energies I'm looking at. Right. So, and then already back in the 70s, Penrose showed that, you know, you have this weird Penrose process where you have like a particle falling to an Uber region, and that somehow like splits up into two pieces, and that way you can extract some energy and angular momentum from the black hole. And then a couple years later, by Zeldovich and a bunch of other people, they showed that you don't need to have like a mechanical particle breaking up in the Uger region, but you can just have a field that extracts energy just as well. And then a couple years later, Detweiler showed, oh, if you actually add a mass term to this field, then you can imagine that, okay, this particle interacts, extracts some energy, but then because it has some mass, it's gravitationally bound to the black hole, and it might be able to interact with the black hole multiple times. And basically what he found is that this is indeed the case, and so this A' field, he showed it for a scalar, but the same is true for a vector, grows exponentially in time with some time scale tau as r. And just to give you a feeling for what these timescales are, so for a vector field, it's roughly like a minute for like solar mass black holes. And so for supermassive black holes, it's equivalently larger, so like order days-ish. I'm dropping a bunch of like scalings here, but this is kind of roughly the general story. And then this instability is most efficient, so basically the timescales are fastest when the ultra vector boson satisfies this relation. Basically, for a solar mass black hole, it's around like 10 to the minus 12 electron volts. Hope this works. And so for a supermassive black hole, it would be like, you know, something else, like 10 to the minus 17, 10 to the minus 20. And so depending on the mass of the black hole, you can then probe different boson masses, which is nice. But so basically, this means that we're talking about ultralight vector bosons here. Right, and so the basic idea of this process is that, you know, you could assume that there is some dark matter density, that, you know, that there's some finite ultralight vector boson density around there, around the black hole, that triggers this instability. But in principle, you don't need some finite density to trigger the instability. It would, you know, just grow from any amplitude, basically. And so you don't need to assume that this vector boson makes up some fraction of the dark matter. It just has to be in the Lagrangian of the standard model, basically, or of the new standard model, and then it will trigger this instability. And then another thing you might wonder is, okay, what happens once it, you know, grew and grew and grew and grew? Because ultimately, this just says, okay, it grows exponentially, but this has to stop at some point, especially because this happens on like a minute's time scale. So it happens very, very quickly. What happens? And so basically what happens is that this cloud around the black hole grows in amplitude, or grows in mass equivalently. And basically, when it reaches roughly like up to 10% of the black hole mass, then it stops growing and basically just dissipates in gravitational waves. So all the energy it extracts from the black hole kind of transfers into gravitational waves and is emitted. Right, so the general picture here is that you start somehow with some black hole that has some spin, and it's basically just a vacuum black hole. And then this instability is triggered, and over some time scale, you grow this cloud around the black hole. And then it starts emitting gravitational waves, and over some time scale, these gravitational waves are being emitted, and then you end up with, I guess, a black hole with like a smaller cloud, or just a cloud with less mass, basically. And so just to give you some feel, again, for the numbers, this gravitation wave time scale happens over like order, weeks? Months, I guess, for solar mass black holes, and again, for supermassive black holes, it's much longer. But it's basically, compared to the instability timescale, which was order of minutes, this is very long. Right, and then this cloud kind of oscillates around the black hole, which is important because, that sources the gravitational waves. You have to have some time dependence. And so the frequency of this oscillation, and equivalently the frequency of the gravitational waves, is roughly like order hertz, 100 hertz-ish. Again, for solar mass black holes, and then a lot lower frequencies for heavier black holes. And so basically what that means is, without any coupling to the standard model, you literally just have, you know, a mass term in the Lagrangian, you were able to show that that the black hole loses angular momentum and emits this angular momentum, or the energy in the cloud, in the form of gravitational waves. So basically, two ways to look for this is, number one, just look for gravitational waves that are being emitted from these systems, which may or may not be easy, and I'll get back to this point in a couple slides. But secondly, you can also just look for the black hole distribution in the universe and the properties of its distribution, and see perhaps, you know, in some black hole mass range, the spins happen to be smaller or unexpectedly small, and then you might be able to infer, okay, some ultralight particle must have reduced the spins through this mechanism. Yeah, and so this entire superion story that I just explained for vectors kind of holds for scalars, and it was first mentioned as a kind of an axion detector or a way to probe axions by Mina and company. Right, but actually the title of the talk is Dirac Photon Superradiance. So we thought about, okay, what happens to this vanilla picture of black hole superradiance when you add a non-trivial coupling to the standard model. And so we added this kinetic mixing that I was mentioning earlier, and the Lagrangian looks something like this. So the first two terms we already know is just the ultralight vector boson, and then this is the kinetic term of the standard model photon. So the unprimed fields are just the standard model photon. And then here, let's forget about the second one for now. This is just the coupling of the standard model photon to, you know, electrons, positrons, that kind of stuff. And so then this kinetic mixing, this epsilon, basically means that now the visible field, so the field that couples to the electromagnetic current, is no longer just the photon, but a superposition of the photon and the massive fields. So basically, the stuff that multiplies I is A plus epsilon A prime. And so basically what this means is that any sort of field configuration of this ultralight vector boson can accelerate electrons, positrons, et cetera. Right, and so just to give you a feel for what this means in practice, so we now have this ultralight vector boson cloud oscillating around the black hole, and because of this kinetic mixing, now the electrons that are kind of flying about feel a huge electric field in which they get accelerated. So basically you have this epsilon E prime, which is the electric field that the electron feels. And basically over one oscillation cycle of this cloud, it can accelerate electrons and positrons up to boost factors of 10 to the 12. So yeah, if you don't know these numbers, this is very, very large. And it's sufficiently large that you can effectively just, you know, radiate all your kinetic energy through synchrotron radiation and then initiate some pair production. And then obviously, you know, if you produce pairs, then those new particles get accelerated again, emit some synchrotron radiation, pair produce again, and then you end up with a pair production cascade that occurs in the cloud. So the big picture here is you start with, again, with just some black hole that doesn't have a cloud around it. You grow the superradiant cloud, which is just basically the ultralight vector boson. And then because of some finite kinetic mixing, you then start accelerating rogue electrons and positrons that happen to be around, which then pair produce and kind of form a pair plasma in the superradiant cloud. And just to give you a feel for when this happens in terms of parameters, here again, I'm plotting the kinetic mixing versus ultralight vector boson mass plot. And I'm picking two different black hole masses, 10 and 100 solar masses. And I'm showing in gray the current constraints by other experiments. And so basically, above the orange and the blue line, the pair production rate is larger than the light crossing time of the cloud. And so basically, you produce more pairs than can escape the system, more or less. So basically, everywhere above these lines, you can the black hole will produce a pair plasma very efficiently in the superradiant cloud. And so then the question is, okay, we have this pair plasma, and we have this weird interaction with the superradiant cloud. There might be some electromagnetic emissions that we can look for in the sky, but how do those look like? And so to answer this question, this talk is designed for a different audience, so maybe I'll just skip this part. Right, so let me just jump ahead and say we did some simulation magic, and we got some results. And the result is that this pair plasma is in a turbulent state. So basically, you can imagine that you have this weird ultralight vector boson source term that sloshes around this pair plasma around the black hole, and that makes it very turbulent, basically. It's like a, you know, spoon in a cup kind of situation. And right, so the electromagnetic fields, the visible electromagnetic fields, are largely magnetically dominated. Why is this important? Well, largely, number one means that there are some regions where that isn't the case. So it's electrically dominated, and as soon as you have some electric field somewhere, you can accelerate particles. And so basically, the technical term, what actually happens there is that you have some magnetic reconnection. Not too important what that is, but basically it means that in those regions you can dissipate a lot of electromagnetic energy into the pair plasma, which can then radiate a bunch of high energy emissions. And so basically the luminosity of this, of these emissions can be as large as 10 to the 43 ergs per second. I guess those numbers, again, don't really mean much here, but it's moderately large. Like a pulsar emits similar amount of energy, maybe, depending on the magnetic fields. So it's not like, but an AGN is much larger. So it's not like this is very, very large, but it's moderately large. And then, yeah, naively, you might expect, OK, we have this oscillating cloud around it. There might be some periodicity in the luminosity, but we find only weak evidence for this periodicity. And there might be, yeah, some reasons for that. But if people have questions, I can discuss it later. Right, so the magnetic field overall has this magnitude, so like 10 to the 8 Gauss. I guess compared to like a magnetar, kind of the largest magnetic fields in the universe, magnetar is like 10 to the 12 Gauss? I don't know, 10 to the 14 maybe. So this is not as large as it could be, but it is still quite large. And what this immediately implies is that, you know, if you accelerate particles in these regions where the magnetic dominance is lost, then through synchrotron radiation, which basically just scales with the magnetic field, the frequency of the emitted photons is like X-ray or gamma ray. So basically, just to kind of like summarize it very briefly, you produce this pair plasma around the cloud, and then this pair plasma has this weird magnetic reconnection regions where you can accelerate particles, and those particles then emit through synchrotron radiation in like roughly the X-ray and gamma ray. There might be some radio contribution as well, but it's hard to estimate. So the bottom line is there are some electromagnetic signatures that might hint at the presence of this cloud. Yeah, just to give you like a feeling for how the magnetic field looks like, I have two plots here. So yeah, basically the black hole is at the center, and then the colorful plane is the equatorial plane. And then I just plotted a bunch of field lines that go through this particular point here, but they're kind of representative for the general picture. So basically what happens is that the cloud kind of oscillates this way, and so then the field lines get kind of dragged around and rotate differentially. And then you can see that the field lines aren't really straight, they're like wiggly, and that's kind of just an artifact of the fact that you have some turbulence there. Right, and then, yeah, down here is a bit of a technical point again. This is about magnetic reconnection. Basically, you have like magnetic field lines and enter a point where they then diverge. And basically, that means that the connectivity of the magnetic field lines changes, and therefore dissipation happens there. Again, details. Right, so now the bottom line now is that we have some, you know, gravitational waves, which I was mentioning earlier, that are emitted from these systems, but also some electromagnetic signatures, as we just discovered. And so then the question is, okay, we have this, you know, whatever, 10 to the 43 ergs per second. Can we use this to actually search for these systems and put some meaningful constraints on the existence of this ultralight particle and the kinetic mixing, or even make a discovery? And so I'm going to split this into two parts. First, the electromagnetic signatures, and then the gravitational wave signatures. But they kind of go hand in hand in a particular way. So yeah, it's pretty cool. Right. So yeah, we came up with a bunch of ways to search for these electromagnetic signatures of the dark photon cloud. So I'm just going to present one of those. And the idea here is that we detect some binary black hole merger with the LVK, with LIGO, basically. And so then we know exactly at this point on the sky, there's a new black hole that has a new spin that we measured and has some mass that we know. And so then we can predict all these things that I just described, like all the time scales, et cetera. So we know when the cloud has grown, we know which frequency it should emit at, et cetera, et cetera. And then we can basically follow this up with some X-ray observations or some radio observations that look exactly at the same point at exactly the time that we can predict they should look at it. And then they here, basically in this plot, again, it's just the kinetic mixing versus the mass of the ultralight vector boson. I am plotting, right, here we assumed three different gravitational wave events from the current LIGO catalog. And we assumed that some fraction of the luminosity that is emitted from this pair plasma goes into the X-ray or in the radio, And then we looked at, you know, the sensitivity of current satellites that look for these things, and try to understand which part of the parameter space we can access with those instruments. And so basically, in the radio, which is the dashed lines, we can see the most. So basically, it goes down to like an order of magnitude below the current constraints. And then the X-ray are slightly less sensitive. But yeah, the bottom line is we can improve a bit. And in the future, this might become better. But yeah, anyway, so we can access some part of the parameter space that hasn't been accessed before. And then on the gravitational wave side, basically there's various ways of searching for these gravitational waves. So like a stochastic gravitational wave background from like a population of black holes that all have these clouds and they're all oscillating, they all send out gravitational waves. Or you can do things like all-sky surveys or directed searches at known black holes. But anyways, I'm going to focus on the follow-up searches, which are kind of the most robust ones that make the least assumptions. And so basically, what we did in this paper that was supposed to come out today, I guess, but it hasn't, so it might come out tonight, I don't know. What we did here was look at the current sensitivity of LIGO and use some data analysis techniques and try to understand how far out we can see these black holes if they emit gravitational waves in those particular frequency ranges. So here we looked at an initial black hole spin of whatever, 0 to 1, and initial black hole masses from like 10 to 1,000 solar masses. And you can see in color, basically here, this is the most sensitive regime, so like, you know, loud spin and heavy black holes. Just because the gravitational waves are strongest there. And we can see this out to like 6 gigaparsecs. So if those numbers don't mean much to you, typical binary black holes measured by LIGO are like order gigaparsec away, or maybe closer, but like, yeah, kind of in that regime. So like find a megaparsec to gigaparsec. So basically what this means is we can actually detect and actually follow up current binary black hole mergers with the particular techniques that we were looking at. So this is very exciting. And so that means that, you know, maybe in the next observing run or even past events, we can apply this machinery and, again, search for ultralight vector bosons in the masses here, like whatever, 10 to the minus 12 to 10 to the minus 14 electron volts. Right. So what are the takeaways here? Takeaway number one is that dark photon superradiance results in both electromagnetic and gravitational wave signatures, and that you can look for these with current and future observation campaigns, and that those kind of go hand in hand. So like, you know, you need the gravitational wave observation to do follow-up searches with the EM, but you can also do it the other way around. And yeah, this is a common, that's again for a different audience. Yeah, whatever. Outlook, yeah, I kind of mentioned this before. You can, you know, look at candidate events in the LIGO catalog, maybe 04, but maybe even past events, they can follow up with EM observations or gravitational wave observations. And so far, I've only focused on solar mass black holes, like, you know, 10, 100, 1,000 solar masses. But supermassive black holes exist. And so they can basically, with those, we can access different parts of the ultralight vector boson mass parameter range. And that might be interesting physics there. Which we haven't really thought about it yet. But yeah, thank you.
Well, I wish my simulations made nice plus like that. Do you guys have any questions?
It looks like your sensitivity goes way down for supermassive black holes. It's because of the
No, it's mostly because the frequencies here are in the LIGO sensitive regime. Like LISA would be in LISA, all of this would be black, and then at higher masses it would be orange, basically.
Okay. Yeah,
just because of sensitivities and frequencies.
Sorry, what are the split? Where are the current streets going from? Like, do you have the streets from?
Right. So yeah, Yeah, so this gray bubble here is from current CMB measurements, and I'm sure Delilah can tell you more about it, how they came about, but yeah, that's the current constraints.
Does that mean that's the fire measurement? They're looking only at the monopole. And okay, so basically, if you have a black light spectrum, that's the CMB, this dark photon kinetic mixing, it causes the CMB to lose power. So you have sort of a, instead of the black body, you have sort of a tilted towards like lower frequency. Anyway, so because the far as uncertainties are like 10 to minus 5, whatever, then your signal with the dark photon should not be larger than 10 to minus 5, right? It should blend into the current uncertainties. So that's where the contour comes from.
So you can do much better with not just considering the monopole?
That's all I'm gonna say. Okay, more questions? I'm kind of, you said a lot of numbers that didn't really mean much to me.
Yeah.
In the beginning, when you were describing the signal, I'm just wondering what, if you can, like, if this signal in any way is maybe degenerate with like other physical phenomena that take place around the black hole? Or like, what is unique about it, right?
You mean the gravitational waves or the plasma that I was discussing?
The plasma.
Yeah, so there's various ways to like break degeneracies to make sure that you're actually looking at what you think you're looking at. But yeah, you have to be careful because the frequencies are exactly in like the pulsar regime. So if you see something blipping at exactly, you know, 100 hertz, then you might think, oh, that's a super radiant cloud, but it might also just be a regular pulsar. So you have to be careful that you don't, you know, mistake one for the other. But there's ways, so for instance, the frequency drift, like the derivative of the frequencies is different, opposite sign. So that way you could distinguish those. Yeah, I mean, you have to be careful about not, like the frequency drift is a pretty easy way to distinguish it if you can measure it. But yeah, you have to be careful about not mistaking things that aren't super in clouds.
And whereas the gravitational wave signal is, does it still have frequency dependence in the gravitational wave?
Yep.
Is there an equation there where you see
that? The frequencies of the gravitational waves? Yeah, it's basically this. It's twice this. I dropped some scalings here, so there's more scalings here. I dropped those just for simplicity.
That mu was the mass of the dark photon, isn't it?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, it emits at that frequency.
And what's the size of the cloud? Since we write it, I should probably be able to do this in my head, but I can't.
The size of the clouds, in the most extreme cases, it's as big as the black hole, maybe like slightly, like an order one factor bigger.
Oh, okay.
But it can go to like infinitely large compared to the black hole, in principle.
And stupid question. Can you have super radiance from the standard model photon?
Some people believe yes. Basically, what you need is some sort of mass term.
Mm-hmm.
And so what people have done is look at the plasma mass that you generate. The problem with that is that people have really only looked at very simplified density profiles for the plasma mass, and you need to know exactly what density profile it is.
What, around the horizon? Or?
Yeah, basically around the entire black hole, depending on how big the cloud is, because you need to trap it, and then your mass is kind of spatially dependent, and then all these rates, all the things that I was describing, all kind of depend on this spatial dependence, which you don't know. And so if you only pick a spherical Kao approximation, then you might get some number, but whether that is actually correct or not is the question. And on top of that comes that all of this is time dependent as well, right? It's not just spatially dependent. So you don't know how the plasma behaves on some significant timescales. There's uncertainties because of that.
But you're expecting this is like, that the dark photons would give you the dominant, plasma generation mechanism, not plasma. electron cloud?
Yeah, so I mean, so what we discussed, or what I discussed here was primarily focusing on like binary black hole merger remnants, which you assume to be vacuum black holes. So there's no like huge plasma around. Obviously, you could think about like supermassive black holes, which usually have like accretion disk and stuff. But then this entire story kind of breaks down there because of technical reasons. But yeah, the basic assumption here is that the black hole is kind of a vacuum black hole to start with.
Great. Right, cool. So we're done. Thank you, James.